effects of the holiday. The remedy was to make the holiday continuous. Greedily she clamored for ever larger, ever more frequent doses. Dr. Shaw at first demurred, then let her have what she wanted. She took as much as 20 grams a day.
"Which will finish her off in a month or two," the doctor confided to Bernard. "One day the respiratory center will be paralyzed. No more breathing, finished. And a good thing, too. If we could rejuvenate, of course, it would be different, but we can't."
Surprisingly, as everyone thought, for on summer holiday Linda was most conveniently out of the way, John raised objections.
"But aren't you shortening her life by giving her so much?"
"In one sense, yes," Dr. Shaw admitted. "But in another, we're actually lengthening it."
The young man stared, uncomprehending.
"Soma may make you lose a few years in time," the doctor went on. "But think of the enormous, immeasurable durations it can give you out of time. Every summer holiday is a bit of what our ancestors used to call eternity."
John began to understand.
"Eternity was in our lips and eyes," he murmured.
"Eh?"
"Nothing."
"Of course," Dr. Shaw went on. "You can't allow people to go popping off into eternity if they've got any serious work to do. But as she hasn't got any serious work."
"All the same," John persisted, "I don't believe it's right."
The doctor shrugged his shoulders.
"Well, of course, if you prefer to have her screaming mad all the time."
In the end, John was forced to give in. Linda got her soma. Thenceforward, she remained in her little room on the 37th floor of Bernard's apartment house, in bed, with the radio and television always on, and the patchouli tap just dripping, and the soma tablets within reach of her hand. There she remained, and yet wasn't there at all, was all the time away, infinitely far away, on holiday in some other world, where the music of the radio was a labyrinth of sonorous colours, a sliding, palpitating labyrinth that led, by what beautifully inevitable windings, to a bright centre of absolute conviction, where the dancing images of the television box were the performers in some indescribably delicious, all-singing feely, where the dripping patchouli was more than scent, was the sun, was a million saxophones, was Popeye making love, only much more so, incomparably more, and without end.
"No, we can't rejuvenate, but I'm very glad," Dr. Shaw had concluded, "to have had this opportunity to see an example of senility in a human being. Thank you so much for calling me in."
He shook Bernard warmly by the hand. It was John, then, that they were after. And, as it was only through Bernard, his accredited guardian, that John could be seen, Bernard now found himself for the first time in his life treated not merely normally, but as a person of outstanding importance. There was no more talk of the alcohol in his blood surrogate, no jibes at his personal appearance. Henry Foster went out of his way to be friendly. Benita Hoover made him a present of 6 packets of sex hormone chewing gum. The assistant predestinator came and cadged almost abjectly for an invitation to one of Bernard's evening parties. As for the women, Bernard had only to hint at the possibility of an invitation, and he could have whichever of them he liked.
"Bernard's asked me to meet the Savage next Wednesday," Fanny announced triumphantly.
"I'm so glad," said Lenina. "And now you must admit that you were wrong about Bernard. Don't you think he's really rather sweet?"
Fanny nodded.
"And I must say," she said, "I was quite agreeably surprised."
"The chief butler? The director of predestination? 3 deputy assistant fertilizer generals?
the Professor of Feelies in the College of Emotional Engineering, the Dean of the Westminster Community Singery, the Supervisor of Buckenuffskification. The list of Bernard's notabilities was interminable. "And I had 6 girls last week," he confided to Helmholtz Watson. "One on Monday, 2 on Tuesday, 2 more on Friday, and 1 on Saturday. And if I'd had the time or the inclination, there were at least a dozen more who were only too anxious."
Helmholtz listened to his boastings in a silence so gloomily disapproving that Bernard was offended.
"You're envious," he said.
Helmholtz shook his head. "I'm rather sad, that's all," he answered. Bernard went off in a huff. Never, he told himself, never would he speak to Helmholtz again. The days passed. Success went fizzily to Bernard's head, and in the process completely reconciled him, as any good intoxicant should do, to a world which, up till then, he had found very unsatisfactory. Insofar as it recognized him as important, the order of things was good. But, reconciled by his success, he yet refused to forego the privilege of criticizing this order. For the act of criticizing heightened his sense of importance, made him feel larger. Moreover, he did genuinely believe that there were things to criticize. At the same time, he genuinely liked being a success and having all the girls he wanted. Before those who now, for the sake of the savage, paid their court to him, Bernard would parade a carping unorthodoxy. He was politely listened to, but behind his back people shook their heads. "That young man will come to a bad end," they said, prophesying the more confidently in that they themselves would in due course personally see to it that the end was bad. "He won't find another savage to help him out a second time," they said. Meanwhile, however, there was the first savage. They were polite, and because they were polite, Bernard felt positively gigantic. Gigantic, and at the same time light with elation, lighter than air.
"Lighter than air," said Bernard, pointing upwards.
Like a pearl in the sky, high, high above them, the weather department's captive balloon shone rosily in the sunshine.
"The said savage," so ran Bernard's instructions, "to be shown civilized life in all its aspects."
He was being shown a bird's-eye view of it at present, a bird's-eye view from the platform of the Charing Tea Tower. The station master and the resident meteorologist were acting as guides, but it was Bernard who did most of the talking. Intoxicated, he was behaving as though, at the very least, he were a visiting world controller, lighter than air. The Bombay green rocket dropped out of the sky. The passengers alighted. 8 identical Dravidian twins in khaki looked out of the 8 portholes of the cabin, the stewards.
1,250 kilometers an hour, said the station master impressively. "What do you think of that, Mr. Savage?"
John thought it was very nice.
"Still," he said, "Ariel could put a girdle round the earth in 40 minutes.
The Savage," wrote Bernard in his report to Mustafa Mond,
"shows surprisingly little astonishment at or awe of civilized inventions. This is partly due, no doubt, to the fact that he has heard them talked about by the woman Linda, his M-dash."
Mustafa Mond frowned.
"Does the fool think I am too squeamish to see the word written out at full length?"
"Partly on his interest being focused on what he calls the soul, which he persists in regarding as an entity independent of the physical environment, whereas, as I tried to point out to him..."
The controller skipped the next sentences and was just about to turn the page in search of something more interestingly concrete when his eye was caught by a series of quite extraordinary phrases.
"Though I must admit," he read, "that I agree with the savage in finding civilized infantility too easy or, as he puts it, not expensive enough. and I would like to take this opportunity of drawing your fordship's attention to—"
Mustafa Mon's anger gave place almost at once to mirth. The idea of this creature solemnly lecturing him, about the social order was really too grotesque. The man must have gone mad. "I ought to give him a lesson," he said to himself, then threw back his head and laughed aloud. For the moment, at any rate, the lesson would not be given. It was a small factory of lighting sets for helicopters, a branch of the Electrical Equipment Corporation. They were met on the roof itself, for that circular letter of recommendation from the controller was magical in its effects, by the chief technician and the human element manager. They walked downstairs into the factory.
"Each process," explained the human element manager, "is carried out as far as possible by a single Bokanovsky group."
And in effect, 83 almost noseless black brachycephalic deltas were cold pressing. The 56 four-spindle chucking and turning machines were being manipulated by 56 aquiline and ginger gammas. 107 heat-conditioned Epsilon Senegalese were working in the foundry. 33 Delta females, long-headed, sandy, with narrow pelvises, and all within 20 millimeters of 1 meter 69 centimeters tall, were cutting screws. In the assembling room, the dynamos were being put together by two sets of Gamma Plus dwarfs. The two low-work tables faced one another. Between them crawled the conveyor with its load of separate parts. 47 blonde heads were confronted by 47 brown ones, 47 snubs by 47 hooks, 47 receding by 47 prognathous chins. The completed mechanisms were inspected by 18 identical curly auburn girls in gamma green, packed in crates by 34 short-legged left-handed male Delta Minuses, and loaded into the waiting trucks and lorries by 63 blue-eyed, flaxen, and freckled Epsilon semimorons. Oh, brave new world! By some malice of his memory, the savage found himself repeating Miranda's words. Oh, brave new world that has such people in it!
"And I assure you," the human element manager concluded as they left the factory, "we hardly ever have any trouble with our workers. We always find—"
But the savage had suddenly broken away from his companions and was violently retching behind a clump of laurels, as though the solid earth had been a helicopter in an air pocket.
"The savage," wrote Bernard, "refuses to take Soma and seems much distressed because the woman Linda, his M-dash, remains permanently on holiday. It is worthy of note that, in spite of his M-dash's senility and the extreme repulsiveness of her appearance, the savage frequently goes to see her and appears to be much attached to her, an interesting example of the way in which early conditioning can be made to modify and even run counter to natural impulses. In this case, the impulse to recoil from an unpleasant object."
At Eton, they alighted on the roof of the upper school. On the opposite side of the schoolyard, the 52 stories of Lupton's Tower gleamed white in the sunshine. College on their left, and on their right, the school community singery reared their venerable piles of ferro-concrete and vitaglass. In the center of the quadrangle stood the quaint old chrome-steel statue of R. Ford. Dr. Gaffney, the provost, and Miss Keat, the headmistress, received them as they stepped out of the plane.
"Do you have many twins here?" the savage asked, rather apprehensively,
as they set out on their tour of inspection.
"Oh, no," the provost answered. "Eton is reserved exclusively for upper-caste boys and girls. One egg, one adult.
It makes education more difficult, of course, but as they'll be called upon to take responsibilities and deal with unexpected emergencies, it can't be helped.
He sighed. Bernard, meanwhile, had taken a strong fancy to Miss Keat.
"If you're free any Monday, Wednesday, or Friday evening," he was saying, jerking his thumb towards the savage. "He's curious, you know," Bernard added.
"Quaint."
Miss Keat smiled, and her smile was really charming, he thought, said thank you, would be delighted to come to one of his parties. The provost opened a door. 5 minutes in that Alpha Double Plus classroom left John a trifle bewildered.
"What is elementary relativity?"
he whispered to Bernard. Bernard tried to explain, then thought better of it, and suggested that they should go to some other classroom. From behind a door in the corridor leading to the Beta Minus geography room, a ringing soprano voice called,
"One, two, three, four,"
and then with a weary impatience,
"As you were."
"Malthusian drill,"
explained the headmistress.
"Most of our girls are Freemartins, of course. I'm a Freemartin myself."
She smiled at Bernard.
"But we have about 800 unsterilized ones who need constant drilling."
In the Beta Minus geography room, John learnt that a savage reservation is a place which, owing to unfavorable climatic or geological conditions, or poverty of natural resources, had not been worth the expense of civilizing. A click, the room was darkened, and suddenly, on the screen above the master's head, there were the penitentes of Acoma prostrating themselves before Our Lady, and wailing, as John had heard them wail, confessing their sins before Jesus on the cross, before the eagle image of Pukong. The young Etonians fairly shouted with laughter. Still wailing, the penitentes rose to their feet, stripped off their upper garments, and with knotted whips began to beat themselves blow after blow. Redoubled, the laughter drowned even the amplified record of their groans.
"But why do they laugh?"
asked the savage in a pained bewilderment.
"Why?"
The provost turned towards him a still broadly grinning face.
"Why? Because it's so extraordinarily funny!"
In the cinematographic twilight, Bernard risked a gesture which, in the past, even total darkness would hardly have emboldened him to make. Strong in his new importance, he put his arm round the headmistress's waist. It yielded willowily. He was just about to snatch a kiss or two, and perhaps a gentle pinch, when the shutters clicked open again.
"Perhaps we had better go on," said Miss Keat, and moved towards the door.
"And this," said the provost a moment later, "is the hypnopedic control room."
Hundreds of synthetic music boxes, one for each dormitory, stood ranged in shelves round three sides of the room. Pigeonholed on the fourth were the paper soundtrack rolls on which the various hypnopedic lessons were printed.
"You slip the roll in here," explained Bernard, interrupting Dr. Gaffney. "Press down this switch."
"No, that one," corrected the provost, annoyed.
"That one, then. The roll unwinds. The selenium cells transform the light impulses into sound waves and..."
"And there you are,"
Dr. Gaffney concluded.
"Do they read Shakespeare?"
asked the savage, as they walked on their way to the biochemical laboratories past the school library.
"Certainly not,"
said the headmistress, blushing.
"Our library," said Dr. Gaffney, "contains only books of reference. If our young people need distraction, they can get it at the Feelies. We don't encourage them to indulge in any solitary amusements."
5 busloads of boys and girls, singing or in a silent embracement, rolled past them over the vitrified highway.
"Just returned,"
explained Dr. Gaffney, while Bernard, whispering, made an appointment with the headmistress for that very evening.
"From the Slough Crematorium. Death conditioning begins at 18 months. Every tot spends 2 mornings a week in a hospital for the dying. All the best toys are kept there, and they get chocolate cream on death days. They learn to take dying as a matter of course.
Like any other physiological process, put in the headmistress professionally.
8 o'clock at the Savoy. It was all arranged. On their way back to London, they stop